Welcome to the first.
Everybody.
Let's get started.
Yeah, she'll be in town till the 5th.
Welcome to the first expanded budget committee meeting for 2019. What on earth is the expanded budget committee? Most of you know, but some folks maybe home might be watching us or streaming us. Expanded budget committee is our normal budget committee, which is made up of 5 members, which for the budget review season is expanded to become a committee of the whole of all members of the legislature. The reason that the legislature decided to do that years ago was that it gives everybody the opportunity to hear the presentations and to question and to vote on cuts and on additions to the budget. And we'll be talking about this budget from now until the middle of November. So you will all be well educated by the time we get done. This is a great budget process. I think our county should be very proud of the way we handle this. We try to be transparent. Halfway through, we have a public forum in which we invite people to come in and talk to us about the budget before we make the final cuts or the final additions. And that, in the past, years ago, folks would have an opportunity to come in for the budget hearing in November, but this gives them an extra opportunity to get to us before the end of the budget. So we have a lot to talk about tonight. I would point out that we do have exits, and if there were an emergency, exit to my right in the back of the room and my left in the front of the room. And if there should be a fire, please don't use the elevator. At this point, I'm going to turn it over to our county administrator. He's going to talk to us about some items in the budget book. Oh, by the way, that's what I wanted to say. Since you got your budget books on Tuesday, I know you all took them home and read them cover to cover. But if you haven't got into them as much as you should, at least please read the full budget message from the county administrator. As former Chair Barbara Mink used to say, it's meaty and has a lot of stuff in there, a lot of good explanation, and it's readable. So let's please do that. And then we'll be talking about the rest of the budget book tonight and as we go along. Kevin McGuire is responsible, I know, for figuring out what goes into what section so that we have a good budget book as usual. Jason, would you like to take it?
Thank you. Thank you, Mike. Actually, I'm going to pass it off to Kevin first. Kevin's going to go over just some routine additions that we included in front of your desks, and then I'll talk about 2 new appendices in this budget book.
I've been selected to reintroduce you all to the giant OTR table. It's the couple of 11 by 17 pages stapled together. It presents Jason's recommendations about the OTRs for the year. Color coding is, there's a key for the color coding in the upper left on the front page, but in short, things that are not color coded are accepted. Pink are recommended. Recommended is not color. Modified is blue, and not recommended is pink. That's the color scheme we've used in years past, so that will probably be familiar to you. I think that's it. Oh, there are new appendices, but I think Jason's going to cover those.
Thank you. If there's no questions on that OTR, giant OTR summary table, I'll direct your attention to Appendix D and Appendix F. Appendix D is new. It was inspired by a constant question that we would ask of what happened with that? What was that OTR for? And what was the outcome of it? And what we did is we decided to create an OTR tracking mechanism. It's in its infancy stages, but we wanted to provide something to you now, which gives you a history of 2017, 18, and 19 OTRs, what was requested and what was approved, and then for how much, and what was the current status of it. It's not in perfect form. We probably over the off season, after this budget is adopted, will create a laser fish mechanism that can easily be updated by departments and agencies, and so it'll easily be collected, the information. But we wanted to share it with everyone. So as you go through the OTR plan, review process and the budget process, you'll have a history of what the legislature had done in the past when it comes to over-target requests, and just give you a little bit of accountability. I think our goal is that, at least once a year, send this out so we have an update as to where things are, and there's some accountability with what was done with prior year's approvals of OTRs. If we have noticed that there may be one or two missing on accident, if that's the case, that's just a glitch in the way we've been able to collect the data, but if there is, let us know so we can make sure it's there. But we think we caught everything. And like I said, next year we'll have probably a better system in place internally to collect the information. Appendix F is the performance, or RBA, which is the results-based accountability. So if you remember in prior years, there was a thick amalgamation of PIAs, which were program...
What was that stand for?
Program Impact Assessment. Yeah. And we have slowly transitioned to each department having a results-based accountability with data that is starting to be collected and starting to be assessed as performance data. There's also explanations of certain functions within departments in the RBA forms. The dashboards are, I think, a work in progress. This is the first year we've had some departments with multiple years of data. Last year was kind of the first onset of it. This year we have, I would say, two-thirds of the departments that are starting to develop data, as this is the third year with the third and final set of departments that are starting to acquire data. This will probably change into the future into a much easier read document, hopefully, and it'll have much more meaning as more years of data collection get under our belt and we start to measure success within each department, and we're able to interpret those metrics from a different perspective. So it's a lot to take in, a lot to read, but just wanted to let you know it's there, and it's slowly starting to migrate out the PIAs and replace for the RBA system. There is, I will say, I think in the back end of it, our ATIs for the first time are being reported on. This is the ones that you would have approved in the 2018 budget. So there is, in the back end of it, is our alternatives to incarceration and some of the ATIs that are being measured with through our criminal justice and performance measurement coordinator.
Question about, I've seen a presentation about the how much, how well numbers. Could you give a very brief, so for example, I was looking at Department of Mental Health and I saw for how well, it said 46%. Correct. Is that on a 100% scale, I'm assuming? And what does a 46 mean? Is it like 65 is passing?
Right. So reality? Some of these I would say that some of it is under development, meaning some benchmarks are yet to be set, some may be best practices, and some may be set by ourselves, meaning that this isn't necessarily an industry standard benchmark, but we feel that X percentage in this particular metric is an important goal to set. So, for example, Jeff Smith has like a pavement condition index, which he measures the condition of pavement on roads to try to identify where investment is best made to do resurfacing or reconstruction of roads. There isn't a hard, fast standard to say you should have a PCI of 70. It's really a judgment call of we're trying to strive for an 80 or an 85% PCI across all roads because we feel that's a good level of pavement condition that we want to preserve on average across all roads.
Okay, and the reason I ask, I mean, it seems logical that 100% would be 100%, but I'm seeing a 216% here. So
I'd have to look into what the exact one is.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So those are available as we go through them. If there are specific questions, you know, I or the department heads can answer them as they come up. I'd be happy to sit down and talk with you or answer any questions you have about them.
Martha?
So far you haven't used the RBA assessments in budget recommendations, right? This is sort of building the information base.
Right.
Is that?
And some of them will ultimately have impacts, you know, could have impacts on budget discussion and decisions. I'll use again the highway as an example. If our condition of our roads is not getting to the level that we want it to be at, this could be a discussion to say, hey, we want to invest more money in our roads. I use that because it's an easy linear example where sometimes the human services metrics are much harder to determine.
Okay.
I'll give you another example of something where last year we created another child protective service unit because caseloads were high, turnaround of evaluations was high, and we weren't meeting our mark with mandated or certain metric requirements from the state. As that additional child protective service unit came on board, those numbers began to improve. So the decision to make that additional unit achieve those milestones of lowering caseloads per caseworker, also meeting the time requirements to doing evaluations and so on and so forth.
Okay, and this might be a Kevin question. The green sheets on our desks, are these replacements of the capital plan, or is this different information?
Yes, quite a bit of the capital plan needed some corrections, and it was we just had some document versions that got out of sync, and so there was a little bit on most pages of several pieces of the capital plan. So it's a pretty sizable chunk of corrections.
So we should replace the white pages of 315 to 328 with the green ones.
That's correct, yes.
Okay, so if I can just a little, like, aging eyes request. For the future pages where you were replacing, if you could do a lighter color. I understand using not white is great, but like beige or something else, so this is a little hard to read.
I lost the argument about which color we would use. And I'm on your side.
Okay, so I don't know how old the people were who were arguing for dark green.
I'm right there with you. The next set will be on pink. Very light pink.
Well, something in between. Thank you very much.
A lighter green.
A lighter green. Something else. Thank you.
Thank you. Shall we begin the capital? So today I'm going to talk.
Can I just mention one other thing? I just wanted everyone to remember that the quorum for the EBC is however many legislators are here. And however many are voting later on, a majority of those carry. But that's because whatever votes we have to be finally approved and adopted by the full budget committee, which is the full legislature. Thanks.
Okay. So this evening I'm going to talk a little bit about the capital plan. I'm going to expand upon what was talked about at the budget meeting, where I just briefly went over some of the larger projects. I'm going to talk a little bit more detail of those projects. If there are specific questions about specific equipment or things along those lines, I might not have those answers, but we can definitely get those answers for you. And then we will close. Also have a little bit of more discussion on the fund balance policy. And there was a few questions about what it would mean, and I put another graph up there to give you an understanding of what that 18% of unassigned fund balance may look like if it was in past years and how it would have compared to your fund balance growth of prior years. So to start off, this is a slide from Tuesday night, the proposed capital plan from 2020 to 25. It's a five-year plan, and it provides a financial strategy for achieving net zero emissions, net zero greenhouse gas emissions of county operations by 2035. Roughly $100 million of investment that's spread over multiple projects over 15 years, and the primary recommendation to achieve that is to increase your annual capital appropriation from what is now 5% in the current year. You approved a 0.5%. You approved a 0.75% at the retreat, and we are recommending a 1% of the capital appropriation of the prior year's levy for capital investment.
Excuse me, Jason. Is this in our packet, or
it should be in front of you? I think it's one of the documents on your desk. It's right to your left-hand side.
Thank you.
Sorry.
It's okay.
This, again, was from last night. I'm going to go through each of these projects just to explain a little bit more about them. The graph itself shows you the orange line would be the capital levy at 1%. I will tell you that that does not assume an annual tax increase above this year. So should you have any tax increases or decreases for that matter, that would either add or subtract to that orange line. We built it off of additional contribution just on the current tax levy. The projected capital expenses is a variety of amortizations, and you probably will see some of that in the capital plan. In the budget book, it's under section 3. What page is it? 27 and 28 gives you a little bit more specificity about outlay into future years if you wanted to see when certain debt hits the books, so to speak, when certain debt comes off. It's part of a much larger spreadsheet that probably goes out to 2040, 2045. But we do make some assumptions of what debt, what is the amortization schedule of certain debt. And then the blue line shows you the capital fund balance. And with this recommendation is a shift of $2.5 million of fund balance from the general fund, unassigned fund balance, to the capital fund. And that's to absorb in certain years when the capital appropriation is less than the actual debt or capital outlay for certain years. And that doesn't happen frequently throughout the process, but it does happen, I want to say, less than a half a dozen years over the course of the next 10 years. That will also change based on when certain projects are amortized. So this, again, is a snapshot right now. Should you decide a project doesn't take place till two or three years after we have in the initial, the initial schedule of this, or the project is less or more, that could change the curvatures of those lines, depending on when the debt is taken on. Green facilities. I thought we'd start with this to match the green sheets that we will no longer have after this meeting. But roughly we estimated about $32 million for this. And I would say $30 million of construction and about $2 million of design. We worked with Johnson Controls, who's done some performance energy contracts with us. And we had them do a review of each building on a high-level perspective, not getting into too much detail, but understanding here are things that could be improved anywhere from building envelope improvement, LED lighting, and down to geothermal options, and even talking about fuel cells and how technology will probably improve in future years when it comes to fuel cells and how that may or may not be something you want to consider. From that, there was a rough estimate of levels of improvement, and we rounded it to about $30 million over all those buildings. That was a snapshot if it was to happen right now. Preliminary research would suggest, and based on that, that it would be roughly about a 90% reduction in emissions if it was to be done today. Considering technology's improvements and what we would expect to happen, we think that you could achieve a net zero emission or close to as possible to net zero goal over the next 10 to 15 year period. It's a changing environment with respect to technology, so we think that there would be improvements that would minimize that extra 10% to the extent it can be minimized. What we also put in the budget was $200,000 for next year to hire some consultants and probably engineers to assist with how do we move forward with this. That would involve anywhere between building audits to feasibility studies, and then from there I would imagine there's some ranking criteria to determine what are low-hanging fruit or what might be quicker investments to make, what might be harder investments to make. There's a variety of unknowns that come with this. Some could be where the building is located versus what alternatives you have for alternative energy uses the construction of a downtown facility that you're considering versus versus other options. So this is really the start, I think, of the process, and having a good planning and evaluation, doing good feasibility work, is what will ultimately lead, I think, to good investments. that was put in there. I will say this, that one of the things we would recommend that if this moves forward, we apply to the FlexTech program, which is a planning program, planning grant program with NYSERDA, that we could get additional funds to add to this $2,000 to help with this feasibility process. Some of the benefit to that is that if we're using NYSERDA planning funds and we come up with a project, we probably stand better to get NYSERDA funds for the actual implementation of it at the end of the day. And I think probably $200,000 is a little bit on the low end when we start getting into some of this type of feasibility analysis and real engineering work.
Jason, would you like questions as we go along?
Absolutely.
Or at the end?
I think that would be easier, yep.
Dan.
Obviously not in detail, but is there also a number yet of what 90% reduction would save us in money? Like, do we know the total utility bill, basically?
You know, I don't have that, and I'd have to ask Arel with what type of information Johnson Controls gave us if they got into that level of detail. It's a good question, meaning what would that mean operationally for us? We know, for example, at the airport that we expect a $50,000 reduction in utilities when we shift from natural gas to geothermal. You would expect some type of proportional similar change to that. How that relates to the overall investment is, you know, is something we would have to figure out. I think that would also be part of your feasibility analysis, because there's probably multiple energy alternatives, and depending on the level of investment and the level of return may dictate what you do.
I don't want to push it, but I mean, we could calculate our current energy costs relatively easily, no?
Yes, yes.
And then just take 9, 10.
You could, yes. I mean, one of the things I think we've talked about doing is just updating the energy inventory for next year as well. Yes, you could do that. The gas portion, more so than probably the electric portion. When you get into LED lighting, then you're talking about other things. But, yeah, yes, to answer your question, shortly, yes. The envisioning of planning work, we think this is probably a 12 to a 24-month planning process or evaluation process before you start getting into design or making decisions about projects and design, with investments starting maybe as early as 2023, but probably close, or 2022, but probably closer to 2023, yes.
Just to follow up on Dan's question, as I'm playing it through in my mind, some of our reaching net zero is from net metering and carbon offsets.
Indeed.
So it's not a simple equation.
Correct.
For just the cost of our production of energy, per se.
Net zero also has to do with energy generation.
Okay.
As well. This is why I think, you know, the balancing of that, where investment is going to have the greatest return, meaning what you approach, you know, what you want to invest in versus the return on that and what it's balanced with other alternatives. This isn't a straight, this is not a fossil fuel free proposal, I would say. It's a net zero emission proposal, if that makes sense. Right. This is why I think I'll say this. This is a 30,000-foot level. Getting into the detail over the next 12 to 24 months gets the specifics that I think you are looking for, as we are, too. Planning is an important piece of this. If you look over to the left, I mentioned $4 million of grants. So I'm going to talk about that after this, after the next two projects. But I identified saying there's roughly $4 million of opportunity out there. You've got the state that's looking to ramp up its investment. They want to reduce their greenhouse gas emissions by X date. Governor's talking about putting together a committee, a council. We might have an opportunity to participate in that. And as that goes, I would imagine the state is going to continue to put money out there available for these types of initiatives. So I think $4 million is on the low end of it. And that's the only amount of grant work I put in combination with this project versus the public safety as well as the downtown building. So I think there's more opportunity. This is just being conservative. Downtown campus, construction facility to house a variety of different departments we've talked about over the past almost 12 months now. Renovating the old jail and district attorney's office, old courthouse possibly as well as the COFA annex. That's the vacant area in the COFA building. New construction renovations would target net zero energy goals. So whether it's a new construction or whether it's a substantial improvement or renovation, we're going to look at it through the lens of the energy strategy and the energy goals we just discussed. Legislature's already committed almost $1.8 million for the purchase of a property. So just so you understand, that is already held in abeyance in terms of potentially put towards the capital project. So when we talk about fund balance at the end of the day, that would have already been pulled out of it because you've already made that commitment. Envision the design work over the course, design, not planning per se, design work over next year, maybe into 2021, with possible construction commencing in 2021 or 2022. Estimated project cost right now is about $22 million. We would envision bonding about $17 million. That means about $5 million you would use roughly some fund balance with. As again, I'll talk about at the end of the next major project, the three major ones, I think there is some flexibility with respect to what you end up bonding, what you end up using in terms of fund balance, and when you end up using it. Public safety building. Public safety building, I would say, is the least has the least amount of information around it right now, but we put a large allotment towards a substantial improvement and renovation to the existing facility, $30 million. Again, you would be approaching this from the new energy standard approach that we just talked about. It does not consider a new jail construction. I think a new jail construction would probably up that number, but this is a substantial investment into the current facility. It may include a new officer patrol building or an expanded on what you have now. Right now you're doing a condition assessment of the facility, and we've talked about at the last public safety public safety committee meeting was expanding the scope to allow for some additional office patrol construction options. So we have to come back to public safety this month and next month to kind of clarify what that expanded scope may include. It's envisioned that this design work would probably be towards 20 to 21, with possible investments commencing in 22 and 23. Again, these are estimates that could be shifted a year either way, depending on prioritization, depending on when information and decisions are made. Estimated project cost, $30 million. What we put in the capital plan was it would be, $30 million would be bonded. So, at this point, I kind of stop and I look at the major capital projects in the capital plan, those three major ones, because all in all, it's about $84 million. I talk about the three major planning initiatives. Public safety building is probably least developed at this time, but you've started to commit some resources to try to understand what that could be. Planning provides flexibility between projects. I guess I should say also, I would say public safety and the green facilities initiative are the ones that have the least amount of effort behind it so far. Planning provides flexibility between projects. What I mean between that is that, of those three, there's $84 million worth of investment. $75 million right now would be scheduled to be bonded, $5 million in cash, $4 million in grants. Hopefully that adds up to $84 million. Yeah. Okay. And really, I think what happens is as projects begin to develop more, you might see pricing go up, you might see pricing come down. And then that allows you the ability to shift more resources into another one. It also may require you to make decisions about what levels of investment you want to make. Do you want to add more into it, or do you not want to add more to it and you want to scale back the level of investment? I will tell you with the green facilities planning, I scheduled that in four phases of investment over every third year of investment. Because you would be spanning 10-plus buildings, it's probably not practical that you would be investing or making one massive investment at one time. Plus, because of the uncertainty of technology and how that will play into some of these decision-making, I took a phased-in approach versus if you were to build a downtown facility, you would build it all at once, and you would take that debt on at once. The green facilities one, we phased it in over four separate investments.
Martha, then Henry.
So our capital plan already includes, or the existing one already includes, significant facility improvements. I don't remember the numbers, but does the green initiative sort of incorporate that? Because so let's pretend you have $1 million for different facility
restoration projects. Yes.
Right. So already in the capital plan.
Yes.
You're talking about money on top of that, or
yes.
would you? Okay.
Yeah, I'll talk about it a little bit later, Martha. But it's very possible that, you know, that the facility restoration initiative that was started, I think, almost 5 years ago, we continue it. That may get blended into the Green Facilities Initiative because they would either happen around the same time. You know, those aren't necessarily energy related. They may be elevator replacements or carpeting or window, you know, window replacements would be. But, you know, it's other building stuff per se that isn't necessarily always related to energy.
Okay.
But if you're going to do a substantial improvement on a building, it may be, it may make all the sense to do it as one bid.
Okay.
Henry.
If we built the new jail, do you have any estimate of what that would, what that price would be?
No, I don't. I know, you know, counties across the state have, you know, have numbers between 40 to 60 million, depending on the size, depending on the make and model, so to speak, or the, you know, the type or the make and model, but, you know, the design of it. So I don't think 30 would be enough to do, at a, you know, the type of new construction from what I've been hearing. There isn't necessarily an economy of scale between a 100-bed versus a 75-bed jail. There might be an economy of scale between a 500-bed and a 75-bed. So it's not like, it's not like a one-for-one ratio. So I don't have that information. I'm fairly comfortable that $30 million is not enough to construct a new jail. We will drill down on that, I would imagine, more with our work with Labella over the course of the next, you know, 2 months.
Anna?
Just to make sure I understood, none of what you estimated included any evaluation of a pod addition?
It did not. You know, I'll be honest with you, the placeholder for the jail is to start the discussion based on some very preliminary information we have, some of the work that was done just in the future, or just recently in the past. I mean, it's a beginning to have a discussion to see how a $30 million investment fits into this capital plan.
And I correct myself, three pods
right.
at a minimum.
Dave?
Yeah, Jason, based on our experience with the airport and the escalation in cost, and we added an additional contingency for a number of years out?
I did not do any inflators. So I didn't do any inflators. I will say our experience at the airport is probably two-sided, that's multiple-sided. Part of the reason you're seeing high costs is because the construction market itself kind of reached a tight market, and the cost went up in general when we did the initial bid. Other elements related to the way the project was bid over phases versus as one bid probably also contributed to it. The tight time frame contributed to it. When we talk about, actually, the next bullet is kind of where I was going a little bit. I wasn't going to talk about the airport per se, but diligent planning is kind of a critical piece to this discussion. The airport had some interesting nuances to it. It had time frame constraints. It had design constraints. It had some constraints that were out of our control per se, or that we agreed to be out of our control. These projects are in your control. So to the extent that you control the time frame, to the extent that you control the design, to the extent that you want to move forward when you want to move forward is going to be important. So I don't have an escalator in there, but obviously if the building market continues to change the way it has, and you continue to see, you know, at some point in time, the engineer estimates will account for those changes. So you'll see the estimates that will increase cost-wise. And that's starting to happen now. Engineering estimates are starting to say, well, the construction costs are up 10% than what they were last year.
You know, I'm a little bit concerned because of the contingency that we're talking about using currently is in the 10% range.
And I want to confirm that from your question the other night about contingency with the downtown property. You know, one of the things Jay and I have talked about is let's get a confirmation of what contingency we were talking about. So there wasn't an escalator. I didn't assume a 3% increase in cost for out years, that type of thing. We can. It'll obviously just drive the cost up, but I think this was just a place to start from a planning perspective.
Well, it's a placeholder and... better to be under budget than over budget.
Absolutely. I agree. So in terms of planning, planning is going to be important for these projects to be successful. When you want to invest in them, when you make the investment. Again, time, you're under the control of time in this instance, so you control the timeline. Where with the airport, we don't necessarily, we agreed not to take control of the timeline on that.
Yeah.
Strategic investments, again, being diligent allows you to make the right investments at the right time. Balancing when to make the investment versus when technology may change or what's a priority. Managing resources, both financial and personnel, meaning how are we managing the construction? What we're talking about doing is a lot of construction over a 10-year period of time. There is an additional engineering position put into the facilities department in this budget. You may have to increase that in future years to help manage some of these construction projects. If I go back 20, 25 years, you had an engineering department and you were doing a lot of facility construction at that time. After the investments were over, you'd stop filling positions, or the legislature stopped filling positions because you were not doing as much construction work. We're starting to ramp up on that again. That may be a natural cycle over the next decade. So a big key to managing these projects is making sure we have the personnel in place to manage them properly. And lastly, patience and motivation. I think we have the motivation. We also have to have the patience. we don't have to be there tomorrow, and although we'd like to do it all tomorrow, making sure that we're making the right investment at the right time and being patient and when we put that out in future years is just as important as making the decision itself. So those are just some key points when we talk about making this level of investment over a period of time. Emergency response. Here's a little bit of a smaller project. There's actually three built into this. One is a backup dispatch center with some system upgrades. I split it up into two areas because if we did not do a backup dispatch center, some of those system upgrades would have to be done anyway in terms of they're obsolete. It has to do with some tower improvements and some other communications equipment. A microwave upgrade. This is replacing roughly a 12 to 15-year system that's in place now. The estimate we have right now for Motorola, which is the provider that we would have to use to make the upgrade, is $1.8 million. And repair and replacement. There's been a deferral of general routine maintenance and some general equipment that needs to be replaced, the generators at certain towers, so on and so forth. That's been spanned out over a five-year period to equal about $550,000. All projects are expected to be covered by the State Interoperable Communications Grant. So if you may remember from the budget retreat, we talked about the fact that we get about a $700,000 grant every year. It's the state's commitment to ensuring that the telecommunication systems and emergency management systems are maintained. Over the past year or two, it has been used a little bit to offset operations, and we want to get away from that so that $700,000 could be fully committed to these types of improvements. And the way we put the improvements in place in the capital plan is that the planning and design work for the dispatch center, I say planning because I think there still needs to be a good feasibility analysis over 2020 as to what would we do. We are in some discussion right now with our partners in Cortland County. I think we have a meeting in 2 weeks with our counterparts there. Where it's possible, we could set up our backup dispatch center in their primary center, and they could set up their backup dispatch center in our primary center. The nice part about that is you have someone there to flip the switch, turn it on. While we mobilize to get up there, we can flip calls over to them quickly and vice versa. The alternative is you create a standalone facility in some other location. So we're starting to investigate that as an option. There seems to be some interest there. And if so, I think next year we would get into some more feasibility analysis as to what level investment has to happen to their facility and vice versa. With the possibility of you constructing something 2-3 years out from now, 2022-2023. Microwave upgrade would begin in 2020. This is, again, you're limited to one provider, and that's a Motorola because it's a proprietary system, and that's your provider in terms of telecommunications equipment. So Motorola would do the upgrade probably all of next year and probably into 2021, and repair and replacement would take place over the next 5 years. One thing I left out on this, I did mention it up there, the fourth bullet, all of these costs would be covered by the state operable grant. So we may have to bond for the dispatch center and upgrades, but those bond payments would be covered by the grant.
I've got Amanda, then I've got Henry, then I've got Ann.
I'm just wondering how long potentially the new microwave will last. Another 15 years?
Probably 10 to 15 years. Yeah, that's probably the life cycle on them. And what you're dealing with now is you've got some equipment that can't find replacement parts.
Eric?
When you say that there's $6.75 million for the development of the backup dispatch center and the system upgrades, what are you basing that, the backup dispatch center, on? Are you basing it on a separate facility or to combine facilities?
It's a combined facility. What we did is Brian has had some of the staff over the past, I would say, 2 months, try to sketch out some of the upgrades that would be needed, both our existing network, what type of equipment would be needed at the facility, how consoles that would be needed there. And then we started to bring Greg Potter into the discussion from an IT perspective, and that changed everything. And then, so we started to develop a baseline understanding of it. That's an estimate. And at that point, it became obvious that we needed to get engineers involved, telecommunication engineers involved, to really identify feasibility of, if we were to partner with Cortland County, what would it cost? What would it be? How would the connections be? Then you get into a really interesting conversation about how interoperable are your dispatch systems really going to be versus co-locating. Co-location is the immediate need in terms of, you have a facility that's secure, it has multiple redundancies and backups, it's a belt and suspenders and another belt. So if there's any power outages, you've got access to it, and there's someone manning it that can easily, flip some things on and get things ready. The interoperability piece is integrating records management and CAD systems, which is a lot more challenging. And so as we went through some of this discussion, we realized the first hurdle is to get a co-location, if that's what is appealing to everyone and works. Otherwise, you're finding another physical location to either construct or add this equipment to.
We've got Ann next.
Thank you.
Martha.
So as far as taking some of the $700,000 that was available each year for system upgrades, so if some of that has been being used for operations, then their budget for operations is going to go up. And then I had one more question.
Yes. So I'm sorry. Do you, what we talked
about? Yes. That's,
yes. You are correct.
We'll get to that in another part.
One of the things I know we did discuss at the retreat was, I think there was about $150,000 that was starting to take away from the grant to be supporting operations. And this year for the retreat, we took $50,000 back out of operations and put it back to the grant, meaning we increased the target by $50,000. What we would do next year is we suggest increase it up $50,000 again, and then up $50,000 the following year, so that the full portion of that grant is committed solely to capital investments.
I'll check my notes on the retreat, but I'm sure you're right. I don't always remember everything. So get going back just a little bit, I don't know if you want to talk about this now or later, sure. But when you mentioned the engineer, I'm just wondering, at what stage will we talk about hiring them? Is that still not in this budget?
Hiring an engineer for this specific project or in general?
Overall.
So I think you have different engineers for different types of projects. If I were to say this one, there's probably some specific engineers we would go with that specialize in emergency management and telecommunications. When we look at the jail, we usually work with Labella because they have a specialty in jails and public safety buildings. When we talk about the green facilities discussion, I think it's probably a little bit more of an open discussion as to how we would want to probably recruit and probably procure a full-fledged planning engineering group that has depth in this type of work. So we haven't gotten down that path, but I would foresee something like an RFQ or an RFP to try to identify those. I mean, that could be multiple, to be honest with you, depending on the specialty. So we haven't had that discussion, but this is a little bit unique work, and it's big, and I think we would want to do a different procurement for it.
Well, I'm really glad, which I didn't say before, but I'm really glad that we're going down this route, so thank you, and to other people and departments who are helping make this happen with the greening of our county government.
See, I think there was another hand. Martha.
Yeah, Annie asked my question about the target versus using that $700 for operations. Other question is, are you suggesting a goal is to be interoperable with Cortland?
Well, it became a question of if we were to go down, can they immediately take on our calls and be able to dispatch through the CAD, the computer dispatch system, because we both have SPILM in the same system.
And then the question comes of control and access to information, and then it comes into disaster management of data, and it became down a path that was very, very entangled. And at some point, maybe worth having a conversation, but at this point, it was just about finding a location where a dispatch, you know, a backup, the backup capability to dispatch was available. And we very quickly got off of that discussion and said, let's just talk about where we can actually have an ability to have a location that would be able to dispatch our folks. So the interoperable discussion is a much future, if any, discussion.
Okay, because that sounds like a whole nother level of investment, and I want to make sure it's worth it.
Yeah, it's not right now. I mean, I think what we want to do now is we want to ensure that we've got a facility that can house the equipment necessary for us to go to another location to dispatch if Brown Road were to go down or be compromised. The ability to have it in a 24/7 operation, it adds value. Just to that alone, you know, I say flip a switch. There's probably multiple switches. I don't know what they are, but, you know, there's people there, and most dispatch centers, I would say, have multiple, you know, security and energy redundancies that if power goes out, they're maintained. If another power source goes out, they have another power source. Those are probably the two primary issues.
I point out at 6:15.
I'm sorry. I'll move quicker. Green Fleet, we put in here the Green Fleet. This was an investment to electrify our passenger fleet. We have about 70 passenger vehicles. I think there's about 10 or 15 that are electric right now, some on order. It recommends making a $400,000 investment annually for the next 5 years, from 21 to 25, replacing about 12 to 15 vehicles a year. That includes the construction of charging stations at the locations. The initial replacement of the fleet would come from this capital investment, but future replacements would go through the normal course that departments go through now when they replace their vehicles. We would envision next year, again, planning, spending some time, thinking about how we would want to approach it, probably reviewing our green fleet policy, updating it. I've talked preliminarily with staff about standardizing some components, you know, so we don't get 10 different types of vehicles. We have a standard type of vehicle or two or three that we purchase. And probably this is going to fall into a fleet management discussion, which is always on the edge of our F&I cabinet discussion one way or another. So we got to get Jeff, we got to get Katie, we got to get folks together and talk about fleet management strategies longer term. How do we manage the fleet? Estimated project $2 million. This would be paid in cash through the capital contribution in those specific years. IT infrastructure. So this is the first time we've committed funding through the capital plan over a continuous investment in our IT infrastructure. A lot of times IT is not viewed as infrastructure. I think it very much is. It connects, 17 buildings, 27 departments, information and storage of information. Access to information is a key piece. You know, when we go down, people are unproductive. We provide services. We don't make widgets, per se. So for us, access to information, data, video, telephone, all of that is important, and it ages, and it ages at a quicker value than vehicles and at a faster pace than buildings do. The average life of some of this can be 5 years or less, maximum 10, depending on what it is. So this is some investment spanned out over a five-year period, $1.4 million. I'll be honest with you, I think this is probably going to turn into a regular investment on an annual basis. And I will say that to a certain extent, this may shift over time from hardware to cloud-based management, which may shift from capital costs to operating costs over time. That's probably a better conversation with Greg to have, but you know, as we start to see, as more cloud opportunities come available and cloud becomes more manageable, it makes a lot more sense because we become less in terms of a hardware manager. Yes?
I was just curious about any conversations you've been having with him with respect to cybersecurity in the cloud technology that currently exists, and whether or not you think that is a transition that is something that can be done imminently, or...
I think cybersecurity is one of those things that is always on our radar now. It's just a constant effort. And, you know, that's a good conversation for Greg. We talk from time to time about it. They seem to be constantly making investments about security of our data and security of our IT. We do regular checks. You know, they send out test emails, and they do tests on our own staff to ensure that people aren't opening emails they shouldn't be opening. So it's
something that I know they constantly are working on.
But he feels comfortable enough in where it is right now to discuss investing in that kind of transition.
Yes, yeah. Okay. And I'm sure every discussion is different, but or every investment is different when that shift comes up.
Henry.
Is there a replacement policy now with replacement funding?
No. There's no replacement schedule. This is the first time we've made an effort to budget money for it. Yeah.
On a regular basis.
And this came up actually in last year's budget process. We were talking about it, and I asked about that, and they looked at me and I said, well, I think we should be spending some interest and time in this. So they developed this over the course of this past year. Okay. Highway and bridge investment. This continues the highway and bridge investment program, I think, that was started 10 years ago maybe. This is where we a lot of annual investment. Jeff does a great job, I think, of managing this. He does, paving work, bridge work. He uses some of this to do matches with some of the state programs that we get funding for. Jeff Lee does a good job administering this, I think, makes the investment go as far as he can. This continues it at $1.8 million every year for the next three or four years, and it increases it to $2.4 in 2024. Total $9.6 million investment. Every year is bonded for a 10-year bond. It's usually part of a 10-year bond. Facility restorations, this is what you were talking about. I'm sorry, Martha.
Yeah, you said in 2024 it would go to $2.4 million, intending
yes.
to continue at 2.4 after that?
Yes. Is it increasing, just an increase in cost of materials? Okay. I think it started at 1.2 when it started and was increased to 1.8. And this would be an increase after 5 years to 2.4. Facility restoration work. This started, I believe, in 2014 to 2019 with a $4 million investment spread over that period of time. I think it was done in $800,000 shots or million dollar chunks, usually done every other year. We're suggesting something similar where every other year there's $1.4 million invested, or probably closer to $1.2 with some design work. Starting every other year with 2021, as we talked about before, as I imagine some of this work may be lumped into the green facilities discussion. And as I think we get down the planning path, we may realize that this needs to be lumped into it altogether. Estimated project, again, similar to the roads, this is usually bonded out for a 10-year period. Airport terminal, I just wanted to touch on this again. This is a total project cost. We continue to be optimistic about PFCs increasing in the near future. And as the PFC options continue to increase and payments go up, new options come online in terms of services, PFCs increase. We've already started to see that increase in 2018's PFCs and into 19's. You'll be able to shift some of that cost that right at the onset of this that might be borne by the general fund, shifted over to the airport fund and paid for by itself. One thing to say, I think I brought up on Tuesday, one of the things we learned as we got into this project is debt that we take on through this project is only authorized by the state finance law to be bonded out for 10 years. And we're going to be requesting state home rule legislation to change it to 25 years. That has been done in two other occasions in two other airports. Considering the state has a decent investment in this project, we hope that they would concur with that and that it would be more manageable to manage the debt. I provided you with an amortization. I think, Rich, you had asked for an amortization schedule of a 10-year versus a 25-year. I put that out in front of you. If you have it in front of you, I'll just show you something real quick on it. If you look at the front page, if you go all the way to the right, it says total principal and interest. On a 10-year amortization is about $1.2 million, $1.3 million. If you flip the page over, it's a 25-year amortization. This is of $10 million. Your annual payment is about just under $600,000. So the difference between a 10-year bond and a 25-year bond would be double the payment, annual payment. I did not change the interest rate. That may change a little bit as well. This is a very rudimentary amortization, but it kind of gives you order of magnitude of what that additional time grants you on an annual basis. Fund balance policy. I can go through this briefly. This is the same slide from before. When we talk about the fund balance policy, we talk about evaluating risks, what we are more vulnerable to, which will help us assess to determine what type of unassigned fund balance percentage we may want to strive to achieve. When we look at the current policy, it's 10%. GFOA recommends 2 months of general fund operations to be reserved. In this case, based on our 2020 proposed budget, that would be $31 million. That is roughly a 16% allotment. When we look at median AA, one county, New York State, they're at a 22%. Median AA, one across the country, are at 31%. Rick, in the financial statement review that he did in July, after some discussion we had, he recommended an 18%. I think that's a solid place to start when we talk about updating our fund balance policy. That means you would be putting aside about $34 million of unassigned fund balance, and that's what we're striving to achieve to maintain a minimum of for financial stability and security. Took a rough shot at what our unassigned fund balance is today as of the close of last fiscal year. Took some assumptions that we know of based on 2019 rollover and designations out of fund balance, as well as what we've proposed in the 2020 budget, and show you that a 34.8 million unassigned fund balance is attainable. I'll stress this again. This is a snapshot in time. It changes. It will change for a variety of reasons. One, that just being that at the end of a fiscal year, if you have a surplus, it will change. And it will change, hopefully, for the better. So I added this just to give you a little bit of a comparison. Several things. The average annual growth in unassigned fund balance since 2013 has been about $4 million. That's the blue bar. Just so you can see, it's grown a little bit, and now it's dipped a little bit, but it's still growth. It's not as if it's a deficit operation or it's negative. This is your total fund balance growth, unassigned fund balance growth for those years following just the annual growth over the revenues over expenditures. So you can see it's grown steadily up to about $41 million where you are as of the end of last year. If you were to have an 18% fund balance policy, this is where you would want the minimum, the red bar, to be. So you could see about in 2015, you would have about hit that mark. Just to kind of show you what that would have meant over prior years if you were striving to achieve that. I didn't go beyond 2013. I could, just to see if it's fluctuated over time, but just kind of gives you an order of magnitude just from a discussion purpose, which we can take up at a GO meeting or later, or budget and finance meeting. But this was, I think, just to show you, you have had a good history over the past 6 years of having growth in unassigned fund balance. There's nothing to suggest that your revenues, at the very least, won't meet expenditures this year. Assuming revenues come in above, like sales tax and casino money, and your expenditures are maintained, it would be a good estimate to say you will probably have some level of growth in unassigned fund balance again this year, at the end of this year, which means this next year for 2019 will be higher. Two things this does: it provides you with a target to provide financial security against risks that you don't know may exist. It also provides you with an understanding of when you exceed that, you have excess fund balance that you can use for other important priorities and initiatives that you want to use it for. And then this is my favorite picture that I use when I would teach capital planning to young, inspiring MPA students. When we talk about capital planning, this is always a good thing to keep in mind. Generally speaking, there are two types of capital projects: ones that have things that have gone wrong and ones that have things that are about to go wrong.
Whoa.
So the more we spend ahead of time thinking about them, strategizing, making the right investments, we can avoid situations like this. So.
General questions, Deb and then Anna.
Thank you, Jason. I just wanted to go back to this issue of the 10-year versus the 20-year amortization. Remind me, the airport's going to be paying for this out of its operating funds?
PFCs. PFCs would be paying, would be contributing towards this, yes.
So there's no chance that they could meet a 10-year schedule and save $2.6 million?
Right now, I think that would be very difficult, if not impossible. Your PFCs right now are coming in at a little bit over $400,000, at least if it's in 2018. If that continues and, you know, use of the airport continues to increase like it has been, you usually save about $100 to $150 a year for regular projects that, you know, when there's the airport capital plan, you know, there's a bunch of projects that never are local costs. It's because you're using PFCs as that local match. So right now, the amount of PFCs we committed to the $10 million of debt over a 25-year amortization equaled about a $3 million amount. So as PFCs increase every year, or if we have growth in PFCs, we can commit more towards the project, which means we would be taking less out of the capital appropriation on an annual basis. If that makes sense. So if we say, for example, we do a bond for 25 years, and it's a $600,000 annual payment, and we have $200,000 of PFCs we can commit to it this year, but that increases in future years, you could then, rather than it being a $400,000 split, it could be a $300,000 split, and then it could switch the other way depending as if PFCs grow.
Okay. Anna, then Ann.
Two things. One, I was curious about the fund balance policy update, and the growth rate has decreased over the last 2 years. I was curious if you could summarize, going back, what you think are the major contributions to that decline in growth.
I haven't looked in it thoroughly. There's probably two or three major factors, and I'd want to get with Rick a little bit before I answer that question. Factors will be, are there major revenues that were received that weren't anticipated, and were there major expenses that didn't come to fruition? My guess is this is probably the first more than the second. Sales tax may play a part in that, as well as there could be delayed payments with other programs, but I'd want to get into it more to understand it, and I haven't done that.
And the other thing, I just wanted to thank you. This is the first time that I've ever seen in any major government discussion of an actual translation of a theoretical commitment to greening government operations into something actually operationalizable and a dollar figure on that. So thank you. I think we're way, way ahead. It's a little scary, but it's you've created a plan for us to at least discuss. So I really appreciate that.
Thank you. Well, the direction came from the legislature. You know, you were the ones that said you wanted to make that commitment. So we tried to make it a reality, and I think this is the first steps for it.
Thank you.
Ann.
My question was answered, so I'll just make a comment that I appreciate you when we talk about greening the county, that you always wear a green shirt.
I will say, you know, there was a little strategy to what I wore today, as I knew I was presenting. You know, I did wear green pants.
You
I also have,
are adorable.
I have lawnmowers, but they're electric lawnmowers.
So we can guess who chose the green paper?
The green. Well,
we'll make little.
I'll reserve comment about the paper discussion. That's an internal office dispute.
Okay, okay. That is a face.
Martha.
Oh, I don't know how to follow that. I think it's just that the red hair, he looks good in green. What can you so on your home mortgage, if you prepay, you get a 30-year mortgage, but you get a chance to prepay. You can reduce this. On a 25-year bond, is there prepayment? Is that like you don't do that or what?
Yeah, you can. Yeah.
Well, there are callable features in bonds depending on how you set them up. So usually there's a maximum amount of time where you have to let the bonds outstanding. But as we refinance debt ourselves here at the county, we did that a lot my second year here, I think in 2015, 14. Yes, you can save money but you can't prepay all of them exactly when you want to. You have to wait till the call period runs out, and then you can call some and refinance the rest, variety of means. I did want to add something about the fund balance policy. When we look at that, we'll be looking at it for all funds, including your enterprise-like funds. And so if you want to know what our fund balance policy is for those smaller funds, that's on section 2, page 30. Kevin always includes this. We haven't concentrated much on it in the past, but there are some funds that our fund balance policy shows at 10% and other smaller funds at 5%. One of the questions will come up, what do we want our enterprise funds to have? I've already looked into a number of other places and also our health insurance consortium. I would not be comfortable with much less than 2 months of operating, which is about 16.6% for any enterprise fund, and that's just for cash flow purposes and for cyclical deviations in revenues. Coincidentally, the Health Insurance Consortium Board a couple of years ago, and this is your money also, has set an 18% fund balance, unappropriated fund balance policy, which keeps our health insurance consortium going quite healthily. And that's basically like an enterprise fund because it is a business. It's run like a business. And so if we're looking at the airport, solid waste, we'd probably be recommending, coincidentally, that same 18%, very likely, as the general fund.
Okay. Thank you, Jason.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Now we start our actual department presentations. And as you recall, what we try to do is limit our time on the floor to questions to be answered. There'll be more time to debate things when we get to the actual voting meetings later on in the process. But we're going to hear from first our Recycling and Materials Management Department. That's found in Section 4, page 160 of your book. There are no over-target requests this year. Barbara Ekstrom, when you're ready.
Can we put you down at the end?
Can we all see you? Please. Get to the microphone.
All right, let me get started here.
That's a great sign. You're going to set the tone for us.
Set that tone, yeah. Set that tone. My job involves financing as well as operations and program management. So it's an interesting one. So let me just go over a couple of facts. Our budget, our recommended budget this year is almost $6.6 million. And we have many sources of revenues. We are an enterprise fund. We are responsible for keeping our own fund balance, which currently has been well over the required 10%. That all is changing, and I'll show you some interesting facts about that in a minute. This is, there's a lot behind this. There's stories to tell, but we'll just keep moving forward and we'll see what comes out. Full-time equivalents, we were in 2016, we were at 15 staff. We are projecting 13.9 this year. The reason for the 0.4 is that one of our scale operators is going to return from 24 hours to 30 hours, which was after maternity leave. That's 0.1. And then we're reducing administrative employees by 0.5 rather, half a position. I did that in light of Jeff's moving from our department to another department in county government. The need is great, but I also had this happen while I was in the middle of my budget process, and I knew just what we were dealing with. We've made a couple of changes in the department about that. Okay, the story begins. Let me talk a few minutes about the largest expenses that we've run into lately. As you recall, in 2018, we went out to bid for the residential recycling contract, and we saw an increase. The last contract had been 10 years old. We saw an increase in $500,000. And clearly that is huge, and it had a major impact on our budget and will continue to. This year we had to go out for bid again for the haul and disposal contract, and that too resulted in a large increase, which you'll see has an impact on our fees. That's $700,000 just in those two, and of course, you know, we've kept the staff and fringes flat. However, there are other expenses that we needed to increase. Don't forget, we are an operational public works-like department. We also have the component of developing innovative programs, and we are a very big customer service department as well. And the story about recycling revenues, I did make a few notes that if I have a few minutes, maybe two or three at the end of this presentation, I can just shed some light on what really is going on. I was fortunate that I could go to the National Recycling Conference last week, and I certainly learned an awful
lot.
Please
take the time to enlighten us on that.
Pardon me?
Please take the time to enlighten us on that. That's great.
Okay, I will. And I'll go over that. The next biggest contract we have, well, the biggest contract we have, is for the Recycling and Solid Waste Center, which I'm kind of laughing because I just can't believe it's been 8.5 years since we awarded that contract, and we're going to award another one in 1.5 years. Mike, you've been around a long time. This will be our fourth procurement, and I giggle a little bit because, gosh, I didn't think that that was going to be me again, but it's going to be me. So we're going to be issuing a draft RFP. Jason wrote in his message that'll be awarded in the fall of 2020 with a final RFP going out the winter of 2020. But I'll remind you, and maybe you don't know this, with the 120W law for these types of operational services, we're required to do a draft RFP, which goes out on the streets, and all can comment on that, especially vendors. And we put out some ideas, and then they will respond. It's very helpful. It helps us to tone down what we might be doing or increase what might make sense. And clearly, I know quite well that what's going on in the rest of the state and in the country, and it, as Jason alluded to in his message, there'll be some significant increase, no doubt about it, in terms of what MRFs, material recycling facilities, are now charging for processing, and there are reasons, and we're going to be in for, we're going to be looking at ways to reduce what we're doing, keep the recycling going, and look at every little part of it. This year, our budget, the cost of recycling is more than the cost of garbage for the first time, and that is true in our nation, and we'll talk about that more. But everything I feel and everything I've learned tells me very strongly that this is something that 83% of all Americans, residential, want recycling to stay. And there have been some good surveys, and we'll talk about what that really means. The small comment I have is the small investment that we've been making in getting rid of food scraps from the trash has been slowly growing, very successful. We take in commercial materials at our own facility, and we're going to continue to grow that, but a little bit more cautiously in light of the finances, but that will continue. I'll keep going. Just a little bit of history here. If you go back and you really look at what's going on, we've got that disposal fee. We've got the annual fee. And what you can see is there's no question that as a result of increasing expenses and loss of revenues, we're seeing that these two are going up. I've proposed increase of $90 to $93 a ton for garbage. That's entirely, it doesn't even quite cover the increase in what we saw contractually, but we had some small decreases in that budget. The annual fee is so $1 of annual fee equals about $53,000 in expenses. And so we're going up by $2. That's only $100,000 of the shortfalls, et cetera. And there's other ways that we're going to be dealing with a sound budget for next year and then beyond. My main responsibility, it's becoming more that I work on the enterprise fund budget 6 months of the year now. And now it's probably going to be even more than that because of the situation that we're going to be in. Okay. So what our assignment was from Jason is that we were going to have a serious shortfall of hundreds of thousands of dollars as a result of everything I described. And we had to come up with ways not only to lower expenditures, but also to increase our fees. I've been benchmarking quite a bit to see what other places are doing, and these are much smaller increases than what it could be and what it might be. Annual fee I talked about, disposal fee I talked about. Don't forget, there's also, the coupons and the punch cards. The disposal fee will go up, but the coupons and the punch cards will stay the same. And the reason for that is we tend to get more surplus from the punch cards and coupons, and we're fine keeping those level next year. The new one, as I talked about earlier, gate fees for recycling facilities in Syracuse and Rochester and pretty much everywhere I've heard about at the conference talking to lots of people is in the neighborhood of $95 to $110 a ton. What does that mean? It means that's what it costs for these facilities for anybody coming in with recyclables. Our contract, we're locked into $60 a ton, but it costs us in the neighborhood of $90 a ton more than that, actually, it's about $100 a ton to take that material, get it ready, transport it, and bring it to the facility in Ontario County. That doesn't include any commercial material we process here, but the revenue values are so low right now for cardboard. Just to give you an idea, we're at $30 a ton, and 4 years ago we were at $150 a ton. So that is in our mind, a necessity for, we don't think that the material tonnage will decrease, but the reality is there's only a few ways to deal with a budget crisis like we have. And this one is very, I think, very nominal. We will not be charging for residential recycling coming into the drop spot this year. We do have an increase in cost for the tires. We do limit the number of tires, but we have to charge more, and we still charge residents, and we have been for a punch card, $2.40 per tire, and we will continue charging for tires.
We have a question from Martha.
Of course.
Hi, Barb. I'm confused about the, you're mixing revenue and fees up, and so
we'll call these revenue enhancements to our budget, and what they are fee increases to the user.
Okay, so recycling fee $30 a ton. right now it's Casella picks up recycling and they drop it off and there's no charge to Casella?
There's two different streams. The first stream is the residential contracted material that comes to our facility, okay? And that is our stuff, and I'm not proposing that there be a fee. The commercial material, that which comes from commercial sources, businesses, and, you know, a haul.
When you mean our stuff, you mean Casella picks up recycling at the curb.
That's right. That's that piece, the residential material that we have a contract with.
Okay.
Them. The second piece is the material that we've always taken from the rest of the users, which are haulers who have contracts, or not contracts, or just pick up with businesses in the county.
And in the past, right this minute, there's no charge.
There has never been a charge for
them
that.
To drop off. Now there will be a $30 charge.
What's that?
In 2020, if we approve all this, there will be a $30 per ton
Correct.
Charge. Do you have any sense, will that reduce recycling?
Right. I'm confident it won't, because there's two things. Illegal dumping has to be enforced, as well as making sure that commercial material is not thrown away. But then again, if the rate to throw away garbage is $90 a ton, there's really no reason why somebody would choose to do that over this nominal fee.
Okay, but you also said, and this is where I got confused, that you said your cost is $90 a ton for recycling. In other words, you mean for Europe, when people or haulers drop off recycling, it costs
our total
you
cost
$90
in my
a
budget
ton to move it out to
it's $90 a ton.
Right now, we're just paying for that out of the budget, and you're saying
it's 30, being paid for out of the annual fee.
Okay, and you're saying that the $30 a ton will help offset that $90 in expense.
Correct.
Got it. Okay.
Yep. Food scraps. Again, we take material from commercial haulers. We run a fine line here because this stuff could actually go back in the trash. But again, we're proposing a nominal fee to take in the commercial materials. Yard waste. The true cost for us of this yard waste being handled at the facility, being hauled to Cuga Compost and paying their gate fee is $90 a ton, accidentally the same as you know, other fees. But that we are proposing we charge what it costs us so we don't lose any money on that. The change for residents is we would be asking residents to pay, it's probably going to be $2.40, because that's the cost of a punch card for a bag or a can. It's very expensive. It costs the same amount as disposal to handle it. Still worth doing, and we want that material to go to the composting. But I should mention that haulers for the yard waste per ton have a choice to go directly to Cuba Compost and pay less, and residents have a choice of bringing it to us. Oops, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do that. How do I get back? There. In the city, we get mostly from the city, or they can, you know, pay at the curb. It's just these things cost money. Electronics, very, very expensive, it's turned out. Markets are limited, and we're paying, again, we have a mandate to for residents not to dispose, or anybody, of what are called, well, the TVs and the monitors, those that have CRTs. And so we surveyed other counties in the state. Again, what we've been offering is far and away, you know, what we did the best that anyone has done. But we're losing over $70,000 a year on electronics. We're proposing, this is a difficult one because it's like $800 a ton. We're proposing to charge for, now commercials are, we're limiting the number of units because what we're seeing now is a lot of commercials coming here because we don't charge. They're coming from this county and they could be coming from others, and we want that to come to an end. We also know how expensive this is. Like I said, $800 a ton. We will not be charging for, and we surveyed what other people are charging and what they're doing. Many other county governments do not even allow electronics to come to their facilities with the exception of the monitors and the TVs. They are basically saying, use the take-back programs, and there are some other places that you can go to, some electronics places. But, you know, again, they charge you a lot of money. I want to continue to take these electronics. I think it's a very important service for our residents. So the ones that wouldn't be TVs and monitors, like a vacuum cleaner, or your cords, or your anything with a cord, for that matter, we will not be charging for next year. And we're going to see how our revenue balancing goes just by charging for the large TVs and the monitors. Yes, Anna?
So what you have written here is $0 to $15, but you said $800 per ton. So this is $15 per what?
Per unit.
So per unit, and you're saying that given what people are bringing, that ends up being, or because of the average weight, that ends up being.
We've done some calculations.
Okay.
And, you know, when you start charging for something, it's all bad. I mean, it's bad because people have to pay it. It's bad because you're doing your best guess. Leo Riley, my deputy's here, and has done a lot of the calculations. But it's way better than what we learned from other places. One of the things that other municipalities are doing, and big ones too, they're just having, like, we have household hazardous waste collection events 6 times a year. They're just having a few electronic events a year. And I think that would make our customers very, very unhappy to go from free, whatever you want to bring in, to only a couple times a year. But everybody's doing it. We're all in a crisis about what we're going to do about loss of revenues.
And does the $15 fee sort of discourage people from outside the county coming
in? Well, yeah, that too. And we're actually going to require that they have a permit, not just like any other recyclable where they don't have a permit, because it's hard to distinguish. We just have to make sure that the payers in this county, I mean, you bring up a good point, are the ones getting the service. And we got to really hone in. I don't think there's many of those, quite frankly, but there could be. And even for our own residents, we just can't lose money everywhere we turn at this point when we're in this situation. So for the food scrap, people that participate in our food scrap drop spot program, we've been offering free toolkits. That consists of a kitchen caddy, which is a nominal fee of about $2 and change for the kitchen, and then the transport containers, which you put in your car. You don't have to use our transport container. We did the same thing a few years after we started recycling. We didn't charge for the recycling containers. Then we went to charging for them because, it was needed at the time. And I think it's reasonable. People can bring it in whatever they want. And if they want to pay for these, they can do that.
Barb, I had a couple of questions.
Yes.
So he says yard waste per bag. That's curbside?
No, we don't do curbside. It's at the drop spot.
Okay, and then also at the drop spot, there's a big pile that you can, stuff your station wagon full of things that aren't in a bag. Like, how will that work?
For which material? Yard waste?
Yard waste.
Yeah, we'll have to come up with something for, I think, Leo, we talked about a coupon. Yeah, we talked about the same kind of, a coupon like you would have to stuff your car with garbage.
And then the food drop-off, you're saying all food drop-off at the recycling center now will be charged?
No, I'm saying commercial only. Commercial. Not residential.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Yep. Listen, one thing that's really important to make mention is this isn't the only time you're going to see this. I'm going to be putting together a resolution that's far more. This is only what's changing. I've got a list of many, many charges that are not shown right now. And you will be, again, considering a resolution at the time we can tell you what kind of revenue we're planning to make, and we have a lot of backup sheets that go with a lot of information. This is just a very, very broad brush.
Deborah, then Shauna, then let's see if we could let Barbara continue.
Barbara, I really appreciate the work you've put into this, and I understand the crisis that you're in. I don't see it getting better anytime soon. Are you sure that these are high enough?
What we're planning to do, there are two questions there. What Jason and I and Leo and Kevin have done is we've deliberated a gradual increase, and for next year, I think that, you can always go higher, but then you start to run the risk of your system weakening and falling astray. So we've done quite a bit of deliberating about all this.
Okay. Shauna?
Hi, Barb.
Hi.
I have a few questions. I wanted to make sure that once these fees were decided, that there would be a way that you would communicate those to our residents?
Okay. We have our kickoff meeting next week. I've created a team in my office of five people that will be developing our communications plan from the time we come to you with a resolution all the way through the end of the year, and it will be very extensive. If you recall, we went through an incredibly big change years ago when we went from when we started doing coupons and punch cards, and there were issues of all kinds that came up. There's no way we will be successful without that communication strategy, and it's going to take, I've got a fiscal coordinator, a communications person, we've got the front desk, we've got, our operations people, and we've got, how it's going to be handled at the facility. So we know that this could change even while you're deliberating, but we're going to stand ready to roll that out in mid-October. I don't know if I can. I can't. Can I roll it out before the budget's approved? No, I can't. All right. Well, we'll get going. We're going to have our plan. We'll be ready. We'll start. We'll have our messaging. We'll start to, come up with what we need to do to be ready in November.
Okay.
great. And then my second question was, is there any type of program that might be able to help people that can't afford these fees with the disposal of some of the items that are listed on this?
I think that the way this went, I mean, you know, I think that when we're talking about, you know, there's residence and there's commercial, mm-hmm. and I think that what could happen here, my budget can't swallow that, but I think that it's something that should go to the appropriate committee, you know, at a given time. And, you know, I would, you know, look back to Jason and to the legislators to, you know, do that. I really think that the one, you know, the electronics fee and the, you know, for residents and the yard waste might have an impact. It might not. I mean, I don't know what is being charged right now at the, you know, and municipalities, one of the things in a lot of other places, municipalities take a lead role in accepting yard waste for their residents. And I, you know, I'm not trying to push something over, but it's probably 80% of our state where municipalities do that. We're just, you know, what we've been doing is doing everything for everyone, and it's kind of like your home budget when your kids go to college. It just has to change.
That's the voice of experience.
Can we go on?
I'm going to go on. Yeah, I saw another hand up, though.
Henry's
That's why
got
I
got a hand.
You just give a short history of 2014 to 2015 when the annual fee went down.
I can.
Okay.
Let me. Can I defer the question
sure.
to that chart? Okay. Whoops. Sorry, what's wrong? Oh, there you go. Okay. So. Well, there we are. The truth of the wait. This we did already.
Yeah, that's what I asked.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go back. Ugh. It's going forward now. All right. Yeah, there was a little dip because we retired debt at the time. For, you know, the original debt on the facility. But at the same time, that was when the recycling revenues began their decline. In 2015, it was in 2013, 2012, revenues were at about $1 million a year. By the time we got to 2014, 2015, when this all began, revenues went down by $250,000. And there were, you know, we were seeing rises also in costs for various operations. But it was a very tiny dip for a very short period of time. But, yeah. What's that?
Martha?
Barbara, on your presentation, I don't see anything here about colleges and the colleges and university.
Right. I didn't put that. I only put the residential fee. There's a lot to talk about with respect to colleges because we believe, and I think you saw this in Jason's information, that it's been 20 years since we had a fee for colleges. It's probably been a decade since we needed to up that discussion. It's more than timely now because that formula really reflects the debt service that we used to pay, and it doesn't now, so that fee is going down based on the formula that was established. Now, I'm not saying it should or shouldn't, but it shouldn't be going down when everyone else is paying more. And there are things that Jason wants to do an analysis on, so I would defer to him for that question.
Okay. Well, I was actually going a slightly different place with this. My husband printed out the Cornell University Sustainable Waste Map saying, hey, look at all the things we can recycle at Cornell for nothing. And so that I'm going on the website, and it's unclear. Like, electronics are in there, places you can drop off your electronics, and it's unclear whether it's there's a charge, but
they don't bring electronics to us. They have their own markets, and they take care of them. Unless it's a student or a member of the faculty or staff that would bring it to us. And we only take a limited, we'll be taking less than a certain amount. We have to figure that out. It's probably 10 or 12.
Okay, so the stuff that they say we will collect, we Cornell will collect, they don't then collect it and bring it to you, right? They do something else?
Not in that example. They will bring single stream recyclables to us.
Okay.
And we have the formula, right?
Okay.
Yep.
Okay, because there's a lot of stuff on this website. But okay, thank you.
Yeah, no, you're right. Okay, this year we looked at our expenses, and other than a short reduction, a small reduction in my staff cost through reorganization, we have not touched the staff and fringes for the year. But we were charged with looking at our other expenses to determine what else could we start to change as we move forward in the next few years, knowing that the revenues have taking a nosedive. We're anticipating at the end of this year that we're going to be bringing in around $200,000 in recycling revenue, whereas, like I said, 5 years ago it was roughly $800,000. So we're at a point where we have to at least start the process, and Jason gave me the charge of starting to look at that. So contractual is a variety of contracts. It ranges from about two contractors here that I notified about what was going on. There's about four nonprofits, and there are several private companies that we're going to be doing without. And it's small, roughly speaking, we're looking at probably, it varies depending on the contract, but, if we're looking at $300,000 in contracts, that's what we're reducing by. Equipment reserve, what that means is that I had put in for a $75,000, we have a reserve for equipment if our baler were to go or we had an emergency in equipment, because any of these things are getting, are aging. The facility itself is not, is over 20-something years old. There's things that, could go at any point. So we've had that. We have about $500,000 in there. But what we decided is we're going to reduce that amount and leave it at the $25,000 for this year, because we're going out for proposals, and if there's any new work that has to be done, we'll do it then. We have been and don't anymore. We were paying for commercial high-grade material that came in the door, where we fetched a substantial revenue, because the commercial recycling line, that we use for high-value materials like cardboard and paper. These days, we aren't going to pay anybody for the highest-grade materials, let alone, of course not for anything else. So those are the small reductions that we're taking at this time. I'm going to go on to the other slide unless there's any questions. All right. So this is the story. Jason looked at the end of 2018 and talked to Dave, Rick, not Dave, sorry. And we were at about $1.8 million in our reserve. Remember, our budget requires a 10% fund balance. Our budget's about $6.5 million. We, that was still good. That was doing well. We've reduced costs year over year. And that's something I need to mention. We have been slimming in terms of what our offerings. We haven't eliminated anything, but we've reduced how we've gone about it and what we've done. And that's been happening since about 15. At the end of this year, we're anticipating that fund balance will be reduced. We're going to be seeing about $412,000 deficit. And then even with the cuts we're talking about or the fees we're charging, or, you know, grants we hope to get, which are pretty reliable right now, we're going to be at that number, Dave, that Rick gave us, which is about, you know, I think you said 16.6. I don't know if it was 18% or 16% that I calculated sitting there. We're going to be at that number. Okay? So this is the story. Now, what I'd like to do is talk about what's going on with recycling and where is this train going. I told you that there's very strong public interest despite some locations that are so in our neighborhood, Onondaga County, Broome County, Monroe County, and certainly some of the smaller counties are currently facing charges quite a bit more, I mean triple than what we're dealing with. They are charging for as much as they can. They are eliminating programs. They don't offer residential curbside collection, so residents are seeing their collection costs that are tied to trash going through the roof. A resident in this county is paying about $30 a year for curbside collection on the fee. These folks are seeing $30 to $40 a month, and I'm not kidding. And I'm seeing programs. We're going to learn more about New York State, but programs are hurting, and I'm not going to be surprised at the end of the budget year if there's counties that are going to have to drop their recycling and let alone their diversion programs. They don't have an annual fee. They're not an enterprise fund. They also don't have their own recycling facilities. They're completely dependent on private facilities, and those are all very bad things. So we have something better than that. The truth of the matter is, and Martha, thank you for circulating that NYSAC information with that resolution that's being considered by NYSAC. I was a part of the development way back when I went to Albany to, you know, bring this message forward with a lot of other counterparts, that unless things change, and they need to in the country, and I can tell you how it needs to change in what I'm seeing, there's going to come a point where nobody's willing to pay. And that's really scary, and it's a big problem. There are those that would love to kill recycling, you know, make my day, throw it away, and there's already some false messaging about it. Product producers, manufacturers, need to take responsibility for the products that they generate. It's happened in Canada successfully. It's happened in Europe, and we're seeing movement for sure happening. Packaging is a holdout, but I'm going to tell you that what I'm realizing is that there are venture capitalists that are green companies that are investing with nonprofit organizations. The biggest one in this country is the Recycling Partnership, and there's another called the Closed Loop Fund, into work that will, I don't know how long, but will result in manufacturers both paying for the cost of recycling and paying for the life cycle of the product. That's how it works in Canada. Now, that's a long ways away from where it could be. But until the entire system changes in terms of who pays, it's certainly very, very unacceptable that municipalities and even MRF operators have to make the capital investments and have to do everything. And that's one important fact. contamination is still a big problem in this country with the advent of the single stream. We have a much, much lower contamination rate here because I didn't go with the carts. I didn't want those to be put out on the street. Neither did Dave, actually. We were both against it because, first of all, the expense, but also, you know, you just, you know, you don't see what's in there. And it's turned out that in the places where they have those carts, contamination is 30 to 35%. China doesn't want the stuff. Our domestic markets don't want the stuff, and it's got to be cleaned up. Our education has been working very slowly. We have about a 10% contamination rate here. And what I mean contamination is, you wouldn't believe the things that people put in their bins. I mean, it's not just dirty diapers. It's, you know, wires and, like everything under the sun. It's crazy. And people have been hearing this for so many years now. So we are going to start a warning and enforcement program. We're not making anything up. This is being used everywhere. Not everywhere, but most everywhere. I've watched it for 2 years, and there's going to come a point where we're going to warn people, we're going to sticker, we're going to educate, but at the end of the day, they're going to have to learn that they can't get a pickup if they are putting in garbage. It's hurting the rest of us, and it's hurting the markets that we use, and it's lowering the price of marketing demand. Now, I'll remind you, we do not take any, none of our material is going to China. So this applies to domestic markets. The good news is that there are 11 domestic markets that are coming online in North America and in the United States in the next 18 to 36 months. And a few of them, probably about most of them, two-thirds of them, are U.S. or Canadian operations. There's the rest of them, maybe a third, are actually Chinese companies that are investing in markets in mills primarily in the United States, because not only do they not want our stuff for contamination, but they also don't want stuff from other countries anymore. They are starting their own recycling programs. So what does this mean? It means that the demand is going to be much stronger than the supply. So that goes back to the question of what could be happening here. What I can tell you is that I'm not going to plan on large increments of optimism here, but I am certainly sure, because the people that talked to us at this conference were presidents and representatives from mills, and it was fantastic. I'm just about done. Glass. Glass also, as you know, is a big problem in terms of marketing. It contaminates the fiber. And, of course, the solutions, and I learned much more about this. Bottle bills are moving very much, very quickly in our country in a lot of places, and there's really no reason why New York State can't deal with the wine and liquor and the companies and make this happen. There's also quite a bit of work going on with processing glass into aggregate, and, you know, making, you know, DOT and highway specs for using this aggregate glass. There's unquestionably going to be a facility in Monroe County here. We'll learn more. Leo's going to a session about where things are. The state is taking a lot of responsibility. But, you know, I want to know how the state's taking responsibility. And I really feel, you know, that there's that part of me that is very focused on taking care of the needs of our county. But there is that little activist part of me that says, all right, already. You know, this is everybody's got to be on board, and things will get slightly better. There is, you know, optimism, but not yet.
Thank you, Barbara. That helps. I have a question from Shauna.
Yeah, I was wondering if you, on the budget sheets, if you could tell us why professional services seems to have been steady the past few years, but it does go up $339,000.
Yeah, that has Yeah. Of course, I can tell you, but I've got to look it up.
What page?
Where's your sheet that shows
sorry, it's
that?
Section 4, page 160.
168?
160. I got to be sure I'm looking at what you're looking at. Okay. I don't have numbers on my...
Can you repeat your question?
I see where you are.
Yeah.
For the shows...
She's going to ask the question again.
Yep. So under the line item of professional services, it appears that the 2019 modified 2018 are around $4.2 million, and then it increases by $339,000 for this year.
Well, I can tell you right now, $200,000 of that is the... is the hauling and disposal. There's also cost of living increases for all our contracts, which I don't remember off the top of my head, but it's probably another $75,000. Looking at the budgets real quick where I'm studying this, recycling collection is further going up with the cost of living increase. The we have an additional increase in old landfills of another $30,000. In administration, there is household hazardous waste. Yep, another increase of about $10,000. I mean, you know, if you wanted the full breakout, it would be very easy to supply it.
Okay.
Not, you know, just kind of quickly. But
okay.
Primarily, you know, 2/3 of that is the new disposal fee, and probably another 1/5 of that is the CPIs that are increasing and, you know, year over year.
Okay. And then my last question is, have you considered having a county resident versus a non-resident rate?
We don't take say that one more time.
So someone that lives in the county,
yeah,
they would have a certain rate versus someone that comes from outside of the county?
So we don't charge. We don't take garbage, for example, from out of the county.
Okay.
With respect to recycling, when the material comes in by a commercial hauler for recycling, it's mixed. It's got stuff generated here, a little bit of stuff generated, but by and large, there's other facilities that other counties would go to. I mean, if you look, you know, in each direction, there's MRFs elsewhere. I mean, one of the things we do want to do, but not next year, is we do want to initiate have permits for all users, not just users for disposal, because that will really help with what you're talking about.
Thank you.
You bet.
Ann, then Rich.
Thank you, Barbara, for your presentation. And I want to thank you also for wearing a black sweater as you talk about how to try and keep your department in the black for the coming years.
Get rid of the flowers, right?
And I also wanted to let you know, I haven't polled all the legislators, but I think most of us or all of us would be in agreement that we are requesting that you stay in your department until we can force manufacturers to take care of their products from cradle to grave and until we learn how to not generate any waste.
I'm on the New York State Product Stewardship Council, and I decided 2 years ago when this was going downhill that I was going to become much more active on a statewide and a country basis, and that's why I'm also on the National Recycling Coalition Board of Directors. I feel like the people that have been doing this for a while, that have knowledge and have, you know, and care a lot about it, need to use their voices.
Thank you very much for doing that.
Thank you.
Rich.
I just say the same thing. It's very clear you've got tremendous challenges, probably more budget challenges than any department will hear from, and it's pretty clear the work you put into this, so it's appreciated.
That's why Jason wanted me to go first.
To show off.
We'll ask him.
Well, Jason. I don't know about show off.
Jason's up.
I've given him probably more headaches.
Not at all. I'd like to say this was a challenging budget. I think we went through, we spent probably two or three meetings together, lengthy meetings, and Barb and Leo and her team did a great job. It's a complicated, it's complicated to someone who's not as involved as they are, but I think they did a wonderful job trying to make this work. And next year is a big year. You have the RFP coming up. I know Barb and her team, as Jonathan has been spending a lot of time preparing for that process, and you'll have some decisions ahead of you, and we have some work ahead of us, but I think they did a wonderful job putting it together, and it was not easy by any means.
We do have multiple goals in mind. We want to make sure that the diversion can increase, but we want to keep the costs as level as we can. That's why only the $2 increase in the annual fee. And we need to know who our stakeholders are, and we need to do our best in taking care of them. And the conversations I've had with some of them where we're doing a little reducing are painful, but we all got to work together.
And
I want to thank Jason and Kevin. They've had an incredible amount of patience, and the messaging and how they brought messages forward about what my job was and how I needed to get going on this after the budget was all done. They delivered it really well with a great deal, not only intelligence, but sensitivity. And I did delay my vacation, so I am going away later in September.
Good.
Last question, Anna.
Thank you so much, Barb. It's so obvious, as everybody has said, what you've put into this, but I think you've also elicited empathy from the entire legislature, and that is a feat in and of itself to lay this all out, such incredibly complicated information that we could digest it, all of us.
So along those lines, thank you, and if there's more information that's needed to help you as you move forward with this,
that'd be great.
Shauna asked a really good question about some of the specifics, but, there's so many layers to peel off, and I think that you need to feel, and we'll share, we'll let you know what we're going to do in terms of communication.
So I have just a question, because some of the things that you outlined, it seems that we have been a leader in the state as a county in the programs that we laid out over the last 10 years. And it seems from what you've described, we're a leader on how to not crumble in the face of what's happening. One of the advantages that we seem to have is that we have our own facility, as you've described. And I'm curious, just so I have a grasp of what we have in comparison, how many counties do you think have their own facility? Are we a standout, or is that more the norm and there are only exceptions that don't have their own facilities? I'm just curious what the landscape is.
In this region, Leo, do you have a sense? Only a couple. I think there might be very few that have facilities. Hard-pressed to think of more than two or three.
They're operating in a different fashion than the contract that we have with our...
We have a very tight contract. And again, Jonathan is excellent. And we, we will deliver the best that we can. And, but it's going to take a lot of, again, you'll get more involved in it. And Jason certainly will. We're going to form, as we did last time, Mike, you can remember, we had a stakeholders group in the county that consisted of the director of finance, the county administrator, a member of the F&I committee, and it's typically been the chair, myself, Leo, and it could be the chair of the legislature, depending on what Jason decides on that. We will have to figure it out. But it's multi-million dollars. Think about how much we spend. If you're looking at a $1.5 million or more contract, and it's over a period of 10 years, that's crazy money. Yeah.
Leslin, I'm sorry, your hand signals confuse me. Are you wanting a question or not?
Well, you gave me the side eye, so I was changing my mind.
Well, I had hinted when I told Anna it was the last question.
I was changing my mind. Barbara, the contractors, I mean, several years ago, we got into the conversation around whether folks are paying a living wage or not. And I just wonder where we are with that in terms of the contract, the people with whom we contract.
Yeah. We committed to doing it. It's being done. Essentially, this time around, the county is picking up based on the legality of how we can do it, getting additional services. We're probably paying, and that's another increase that we've seen mm-hmm. over time. It's probably about $150,000 to $180,000 on this contract, and it's going up because there's a new living wage, but we've continued to do it. This time around, my intent is to keep that living wage a requirement as it states in our policies, but this time around, they are going to have to include it in their proposals, and that's really the way. We can't, I mean, if there's policy that says what we need to do, I mean, it would take a board of legislative decision to reverse that.
Okay. Thank you.
Barbara, thank you so
much. Thank you very much. Have a
Leo, we appreciate the work you did on it as well. Kevin.
Mike, I just wanted to mention in part in answer to Shauna's question about professional services for recycling and materials management and any of the other departments, the material that's presented to you in the contracts appendix is entered by departments in a way that feeds directly, typically, into the professional services and the contract service contracts line items. So it gives you the kind of breakdown in part that you're looking for.
And you may have questions, and there are 45 distinct entities that we have contracts with, ranging from a small nonprofit like the Science Center all the way on up. So
when you all read the whole book last night, you saw that, I'm sure.
Sure did.
But thank you. That's great information, Kevin. We appreciate it. Now, let me put a question to everybody. Normally, we take a break at this point. We have one more department. What would you like to do? Take the break?
I think Katie wants us to go ahead.
Well, what I want to know what the legislature wants.
Go ahead.
5 minutes. All right, I'm hearing 5 minutes.
Take a group.
5 minute break. Be back at 8:20. 7:20, rather. 7:40. 7:40. Let's take our seats.
A different kind of operating.
We do have to put some of the
Yeah. Oh, thank you.
Next up tonight is our Department of Planning and Sustainability, Tourism. This is section 4, page 146 in your book. There are four over-target requests, three of which have been recommended by the county administrator and one which has not. And we have our commissioner of planning, Katie Borgella. When you're ready, Katie.
Great. Thank you very much. And I don't know what you're going to do about my outfit. I do have pineapples on. In case
I've had a couple hours to think about it, okay. So I'm good.
Good. All right.
But those are pineapples. Okay, hold on.
Yeah, no. Great. All right. So the recommended budget includes several items. You can see that both revenue and expenditures are down from 2019. As every year have to explain, we get a lot of grants, we manage a lot of grants, and it's often this mismatch of when grants come in and expenditures go out. Grants that showed up in the 2019 budget but not in 2020 equaled almost $750,000, $375,000. The Resiliency and Recovery Plan, the Cougar Lake Blue Way Trail, and the NYSERDA grant for the electric vehicle purchase support for the county. We also are slated to purchase an electric vehicle replacing our 2010 Prius in our department. And we had the addition of the Municipal Parks and Recreation Grant funds in our budget in 2019 as well. So the major, in thinking of the big picture of the budget, it might be a little confusing in the budget book. There are a bunch of accounts that are zeroed out this year. We've been working hard to try to streamline our accounting systems in the department, and that's why you see some of those being zeroed out. So we basically have one major account. The 80-20 is our main account that we do all of our accounting through. So the major influences that are influencing our department and the kind of the community at large, really the urgency and immediacy of climate change and adaptation that results in the energy strategy that you adopted recently, as well as all the work we're doing trying to prepare the community for a future disaster. Another major influence is affordable housing. Just this need to have housing be affordable near jobs and services, particularly for homeless population all the way through moderate income individuals and families. And we're hearing more and more from businesses that recruiting and retention is becoming a real problem, and so we need to be working on that. Water quality is rearing its head more and more as an issue with harmful algal blooms. We expect the DEC will release their draft total maximum daily load plan. We've been hearing this for a long time, but I do understand it's in final internal review, so we're waiting for that and what exactly that's going to mean for the community. And then tourism, trying to make sure we maintain our tourism and build it by getting more tourists in, especially during the off seasons. Our full-time equivalents are we're hoping to increase our target by one of our OTRs for target funding for our senior planner energy specialist, so 10.7. Full-time equivalents. And then, as Mike mentioned, we have four OTRs, three of them recommended in the budget, and one that is kind of considered a pass-through that we ask for you to make a decision on. So I'm going to go one by one through our OTRs and try to explain them. They are kind of complicated, I acknowledge that, with this initial slide, trying to make it clear. On budget book 150, page 151, I just wanted to walk this through because it is pretty complicated. So what we're doing with the Business Energy Advisors Program is we're not requesting the third year of a three-year OTR. Instead, we are requesting some money as target in this year, in the 2020 budget, being offset by the remaining grant funds. And then next year, we would be requesting that the rest of the target funding be approved so it's a fully funded position by the end of 2021.
One more time. Say it fast.
I'm just kidding.
Okay.
So we would be, instead of asking for the $50,000 for the third year of the OTR for this position, this program, in this year's budget, instead we want to, honestly, we want to retain this outstanding employee that we have. We want to give businesses predictability that this program is going to continue. It's been wildly successful, and we want to build on that. And I'll go into that in a minute. But anyway, so we'd like to bump that up a little bit by giving the assurance that at least half of the position would be target funded next year, offset by the grant, and then the next year we would be able to incorporate the full funding for the position and the program. So, again, I mentioned the predictability for businesses and staff, but wanted to let people know that this position has also been very helpful to county operations. Right now, Andrea is working on developing proposals in response to NYSEG's non-pipe alternative request that's out right now for the airport for the geothermal system. She's also working with New York Power Authority on trying to move along a proposal they're trying to come up with around public facilities in the moratorium area to support transitioning to off of gas for those entities as well. And she's done some background work for the capital program for Jason and myself and Arel, helping us think through what this green facilities program might look like and, you know, making sure the numbers are as accurate as we can get them right now.
Go ahead,
Mark. Is that you okay with questions in the?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Part of the Business Energy Advisors Program was the consulting money from TCAD. Is that expected to continue? I can't remember if they made a multi-year commitment or what.
Yeah, well, they made a three-year commitment as well, so they'll be on their third year next year. I will say that funding goes directly to the energy consulting companies. We don't get any of that for our staff support. It goes directly to assisting the businesses that are working with us.
Right, I got around the gifting problem.
Yeah.
And so it also doesn't show up here. Right.
Well, show it shows here. Up if you see on the chart at the top line. That's TCAD for the consultants, and then the second to last line is the outflow.
Expenditure. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Okay.
And
great.
There isn't a formal commitment for future years by TCAD, but you know, I've been saying I haven't been in a meeting with Heather where she doesn't talk about how great this program is. So I think the future is pretty solid for a while at least.
Okay, great. Thank you.
And just to give you a little progress report, we so far have had 38 program, formal program inquiries with the BEA program, 19 energy charrettes. That is 63% of our three-year goal for our grant has been met in this first year. We do have an application into the Park Foundation right now to try to get more money to augment what TCAD is giving for the energy consultants to help businesses. And I really think that these quotes from letters from developers are pretty powerful of the value of the program. So the next OTR that we have is the Municipal Housing Affordability Infrastructure Grant. I want to make note, Kevin, you're going to hate me, but I found a typo in the budget book on page 152. That OTR, and it's probably our typo, not yours. That should be year one of a three-year OTR, not year two.
Where are you?
I'm on page 152 at the top of the page.
First one, year one of the three-year OTR.
Yeah. So what we're doing with this one, we feel like this is a grant that is very well aligned with our comprehensive plan and a lot of the strategies that we've put out about how to build capacity within our municipalities. And so we'd like the opportunity to test this out for a three-year period and give some predictability so that municipalities can plan to apply for this grant program. It's hard when it's a one-year pilot like this to give people enough time to think of something they really want to do and get an application in. So last year was a one-year OTR funded with rollover money, and we're proposing a three-year OTR, and that next year would be year one, at $30,000 a year of funding. We are proposing applying $20,000 of our rollover money, which is basically all of it, to this program for 2020. And after 2022, we would, in 2022, we'd do an assessment of what this really did to impact affordable housing. So the goal is to assist municipalities.
I have another question here.
Excuse me,
Katie.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Martha.
So for 2019, you had 45 in rollover that you offered, and 15 was used by the town of Lansing and the village of Dryden, right?
Mm-hmm.
So so you have 20 left. You're proposing put an additional 10,000.
30. You're requesting 20,000 rollover to the next year, and adding, you're requesting another 30,000 to make it a total $50,000 pot to administer.
Okay, 50,000. Is the intention kind of 50 every year, or until it gets used up, or?
Well, the intention is 30,000 a year, but we would alter that if we needed to.
Okay. Sure.
So, then are we doing...
Oh, I'm sorry, 50. No, you're right, 50.
Yeah. Okay.
Deborah?
So there wasn't a lot used last year.
Right.
I know that that's probably attributable to a number of different reasons. Would you care to elaborate on what some of them are and how you hope that'll change going forward?
Yeah, sure. I will say in October we have another deadline for a round of funding, so we don't know what people might be proposing then. We were trying to time it around when the next CDBG awards are announced, the applications are announced. We've heard from, a bunch of different municipalities that they're interested in it. They just don't, it's new to a lot of them looking at trying to get consulting help or apply for grants and understanding how to do it. And so I think this year it was very well attended, the workshop that we had, where we had a number of consultants come, municipal board members attended so that they could learn about, what the grant opportunities were. I would like to do something like that next year. Actually, at that the recent intermunicipal organization meeting, I was talking with Bud Shattuck, who is the mayor of Union Springs now, and he runs five grant programs, but he does it with consultant help. Right. And he hires people to write the grants for him, administer the grants for him, and he's got, I think he said, $500,000 of grants running through his little village right now. So that's what the hope of this program is. We've heard from, I think, about five municipalities that they're interested, and they are actively talking about it. But it's unknown whether they will actually be able to apply for it or not.
If I could follow up on that for just a minute, it would be really great if he would come down and talk to some of our smaller villages in Tompkins County, because I know there's so much pushback just in my village. The mayor just feels like, well, there's just no way that we have the bandwidth to manage a grant, and it would be refreshing if someone could show him how that can happen.
Thank you because that's where I was going with that, is that in the winter I would like to do that, have Bud come down and maybe try to mentor a little bit some of these municipalities who might be nervous about it or not know how to go about it.
Thank you, Katie.
I recall you presenting this at HED, and I understand part of the slow pickup was because you're trying to coordinate it also, as you just mentioned, with the CDBG grant rounds, and so that they're applying and then can use whatever consulting to then apply for the CDBG. And if I recall, it had already passed, or there was something that kind of said it so that it was a slower uptake than on an the annual calendar schedule.
Right.
Is that?
Yeah, and they haven't had the CDBG round yet, and they had just finished it last time.
That's what I recall.
Let me just tell people about the two grants so you get a flavor for the people who have applied and used these funds. The first was Town of Lansing. So they are nearly contracted with a consultant on their town center traffic study. So that's how one entity used it. The Village of Dryden, they did hire a consultant. They did a conditions survey of their housing, so they're prepared to be able to apply for, hopefully, the fall round of CDBG money.
Shauna?
Yeah, I was wondering, it appears that on section 4, page 146, on your actual budget sheet here, you have $206,310 of OTRs. And on the actual OTR sheet, there are 1, 2, 3, 4 OTRs, and the total is $96,000. Is there something that's missing on the OTR sheets? So maybe I'm looking at this wrong.
Sorry, I was looking for the page you were on the whole time you were talking, so I didn't get the numbers you were looking at.
Yeah, so I was looking at the...
Joan seems like she knows the answer.
I think it might be confusion between the net versus the net for the department, so accounting for revenues as well as expenditures.
Okay.
So the net is $96,000, which I think matches the other place you were referencing.
You got to look at the bottom of the page. It says department net local. That factors in expenses and revenues.
Okay, gotcha.
Because some of the OTRs, or one of two of the OTRs, has revenue that offsets.
Okay, gotcha. That makes sense. Okay, thank you.
Good question.
Go ahead, Katie.
Okay, thanks. The third OTR that is recommended for funding in the budget is the Southern Tier 8 membership dues. And so this is year 3 of a 3-year OTR. So next year, the plan is that we would do a kind of a formal evaluation of what we're getting out of the membership. And just a reminder, it's $10,000 annual dues to be part of the regional board. There are monthly meetings where it's the planning directors getting together, so you really can't have any other staff go, so I do attend those. So that's what the request is. The goal is increasing collaboration. We do have a principle in our comprehensive plan calling for regional cooperation in our planning, and it is an entity that is doing that across the Southern Tier region. And I thought people might be interested to see the Southern Tier 8's 5-year plan goals. You can see they're very focused on economic development, employment, infrastructure issues, and health is a big push, and also just this focus on the small rural communities.
I'm glad to see that you're going to take a look at what it's providing for you. As you know, we dropped out of it some years ago because we didn't think we were getting much service from Southern Tier East. Most of it was going to Binghamton and Broome County. I would be interested in knowing, when you're doing that study, if we're getting $10,000 worth of services out of them.
Okay. Yeah, I did talk to the executive director when I saw her a couple weeks ago, and I told her that we would do this evaluation, and she said, yeah, that's no problem. We've got those figures, and I'm happy to come talk to the committee. And so they know that this is in the works.
Great. Hands. I don't know. Dan, why don't you go, then Ann.
I have two questions. One's related to that. In the OTR for the membership dues, it says that three local organizations got grants that would not have been able to if we hadn't been part of this organization. Town of Newfield, Groundswell, and Cooperative Extension. Can you give us a quick idea of what those grants were?
Sure. That's in this slide. So Town of Newfield, it was for a water study, looking at their water systems. They have some concern over the adequacy of their public water to serve their people. Groundswell, So you're testing my memory here, because
okay,
these projects go, it takes a very long time for them to get funded. So these were actually 2018 applications. I think it was their farmer incubator program where they were trying to particularly hit people who haven't farmed before and kind of mentoring them and training them on farming practices. And the cooperative extension was expanding their Internet of Things program to actually some of the surrounding municipalities.
Okay, and again, if you don't have this in your head, that's fine. But what's the value of those grants? Are they more than $10,000 right there?
You can see on the third bullet at the bottom, the total of all three of those was roughly $234,000.
So are we saying that without the $10,000, they wouldn't have gotten that grant?
Yes, that is that's true.
And they did get these grants?
No.
Well, it's pretty darn close, and okay. I'm pretty positive. You know, it still hasn't been officially awarded, but I've heard from them that they probably have.
So if they get those grants, that way pays off the investment.
I was of the impression when we withdrew that didn't foreclose us from applying for grants back then.
No, it doesn't. It does.
They have dug into this quite a bit in the last couple of years, and at least Southern Tier 8's interpretation is that it is definite that we cannot apply for these ARC funds. But that would be part of this evaluation, is to make sure that we agree with that analysis. But they're pretty clear on that.
Anna?
Just so that we're all on the same page, Katie, my understanding is that applications from all of the participating counties go to ST8. They are reviewed at ST8, and then we select a series from all of the participating counties that goes to the state. The state then selects from all of those, from all of the regions in the state, those that they want to send to the feds. Then the feds do an evaluation. So I just want to make sure everybody realizes how many steps this actually goes through. So it's a complicated thing. If you know, like Groundswell applied in 2018, they may not get the money until 2020. So it's a very long process.
Anne?
Thank you. One thing I was wondering, because they talk about economic development and various aspects of that with infrastructure, employment, marketing, and such. Do they ever deal with energy efficiency, renewable energy, as far as business development?
I don't know that answer. I do know, that's been one interesting thing for me participating in the planning directors' meetings, is that several of our surrounding counties are dealing with those Article 10 proceedings right now around renewable energy, which are the really big, like 100 megawatt solar panel farms. So there might be more and more interest in that. I know that that first bullet, the energy infrastructure assessment work that's being done, is trying to kind of quantify all of the existing resources, and then the next step will be looking into the future at what the trends are and where it'll be going. I think it's an emerging issue, and I think that our whole region is kind of being surprised by the level of interest they're seeing in large-scale renewables.
Yeah. Because this ties in with, you know, the outfit that you have on with the pineapples, because which symbolize welcome, friendship, and warmth, and with the global warming issues, you know, so thank you. Don't expect that every night.
I thought pineapples.
I have to be careful what I wear next time.
I thought pineapples were New England.
You turned into the Vogue magazine.
Thanks for noticing.
Come on, folks.
I thought pineapples had to do with New England, but I was trying to figure it out. All right. Mike, I think there was a real shift from Southern Tier East to Southern Tier 8, and there's been since the days when Ed Marks recommended we weren't getting anything out of Southern Tier East. There's been new leadership, and
it was Jim Hansen. It wasn't
it was Jim Hansen.
Yeah, but it was. But also, Ed Marks recommended we, you know, hey, yeah. this wasn't worth our time or money. And
well,
I think that there's real
changed. I'm glad to hear it.
That's, yeah, I think there's really been a big change. And Jen, I can't remember her last name, but
Gregory
is very dynamic and is really really happy to have. I mean, I've met her in a couple of meetings. Happy to have Tompkins County's influence, especially on such as these energy issues.
Okay. Dan?
On the OTR about the Business Energy Advisors Program, I would be interested in a little, I think the committee has probably heard this, but I haven't, just a little more information about how the program is being successful. You know, it says nearly 20 businesses have participated. I would just be interested, it doesn't have to be right now, but I'd just be interested in a little more depth of what actually has happened, you know, how that's translated to specific projects or carbon reduction or whatever way we can measure it.
Yeah, I'm happy to share that. We actually just pulled that together for the Park Foundation as well, so we're happy to share that. It doesn't get to the level of carbon reduction because this is all new construction and it's a one-year-old program. So most of these facilities have not broken ground yet. Well, some have, but most haven't broken ground yet, so we don't know yet what the carbon reduction is. But, yeah.
Okay, go ahead. You're done.
Does Anna want
to? I just wanted to add. Yep. I just wanted
Anna, I didn't see your hand.
No, that's okay. So I've been going to the SD8 meetings as well, and I just wanted to point out something following up on what Martha was saying. They have hired an accountant, a bookkeeper that works with them now regularly, and they do financial meetings for all the county representatives at all the quarterly meetings. So the infrastructure has changed dramatically from what I understand it was previously. The ship is much tighter. So to address some of the concerns, Mike, that infrastructure was not in place previously.
Glad to hear it. Okay. Ready to proceed?
Yes. So there's one over-target request that is not in the recommended budget, and just like previous years, this is the advisory board priorities. We've viewed this as the legislature's advisory board, so neither Jason or I kind of make a recommendation one way or the other. It's something that you should hear directly from them. So it's a one-year OTR, two parts to it. The first is from the EMC. They are asking for $2,000 to conduct public education on environmental matters. They'd like to print some brochures looking at what steps different groups could take to control flooding and adopt carbon sequestration practices. And then the second one is to the Water Resources Council. This was an OTR that was approved for a 2019 budget for $8,000 to do this map of Cayuga Lake, looking at the boating services, but also information on how to have a clean boating technique so that we wouldn't get the invasives moving from one water body to another. They asked us to put this in for 2020 because the map isn't printed or fully designed yet, so if they do manage to get it printed this year, then they wouldn't spend that money, but they aren't sure they're going to be able to, so they would like to in 2020.
Dan?
I'm a little confused. We approved it last year, but they didn't spend it. We need to approve it again?
Yeah, isn't it a roll-up?
It was a one-year OTR, so.
But it wasn't expended.
If they don't expend it, it would just go back in the fund balance. It would come back to you.
Okay.
Joan, did you want to say something?
No, that's fine. Thank you.
Okay.
Great. So we also wanted to present the tourism budget. Since this is administered through the Department of Planning and Sustainability. Just a reminder that this is all funded through the hotel room occupancy tax. All of the program revenues come from that tax, and any of the grant awards require the legislature to approve them. And that we have the proposed budget is approved by STPB every summer, and there are no over target requests. So that's a good thing. We put it program budget into the same kind of format that you're used to seeing with all the other budgets. It is a little bit more confusing because it's not normally in this way. But this budget has three parts to it. The first part is kind of other allocations. It's on page 34 of your budget book. You would see where all of this information is. It's about $500,000, which includes the 10% that the county keeps for administration, as well as the allocation to TCAD for general support for their operating budget. And what?
Page 34.
Yep. It's up on the slide,
section
too.
Section 2.
Thank you.
Sorry, section 2, page 34.
And then it also pays for the planning and sustainability staff support for the STPB. The second part is the tourism promotion, which is in the budget book on page 194, and that's about $2.5 million.
That's section 4.
Thank you. And so I did the math for you, so it can add up to something you see on the screen. So that means the expenditures are just over $3 million. The revenues are just over $3 million. And the STPB is recommending putting roughly $17,000 into their reserves because they have set a policy to maintain a 5% reserve balance. So where these numbers come from, we've got...
Can I ask why they need a reserve balance?
Yes.
Helmholt, the tourism director.
Yeah, certainly. The reserve balance would be used in case there is an unexpected decline in room tax revenue to offset any shortfalls in urgent needs and dispersing funds and reprogram as needed.
So in a current year?
Correct.
They might need to use it. Okay.
Yeah. Rainy day fund.
And so this slide shows the projected revenue of just over $3 million. That's a 4% increase compared to 2019. This is developed by a committee of the STPB where they look at past trends and project into the future. And this is actually aligning quite closely their 2019 number with quarter one and quarter two that we have in hand so far. And this is kind of a big picture look at expenditures. We've got the 60-40 policy around these funds with 60% of it going to marketing, 40% to product development, which in non-tourism speak are the grant programs that fund a lot of amenities and festivals and that type of thing. And then the other category is the wages and benefits of the support staff, again, the TCAD funding, the strategic tourism initiative grants, and the contribution to reserves, which you can see is about $183,000 projected. And that's our staff. Yeah.
Martha.
Katie, could you go back to the room tax revenue, two slides? Yeah. This is the forecast, but then, so does the fourth quarter usually drop like that? September, November?
Yes.
There you go. Okay, but I thought...
Very nice.
Oh, man, I think
very
succinct.
Been here too long.
Very, very succinct.
So that's a simple answer.
All right, sorry if this seems like a stupid question, but so the 2019 is not finished. Are you? But that is the.
Would you like Nick to talk through how they do the projection?
Sure. I mean, Q1 is December to February, not January. I'm confused.
So the quarters here represent our financial quarters when we receive room taxes from the hotels and other lodging establishments. This aligns very closely with our historical pattern of how room taxes have been received over the past 10 years, actually longer than that, since 2004. And it also takes into account one-time events such as the displacement of people from the Maplewood that affected last year's room tax and new inventory that's coming online, such as the Canopy Hotel. So this room tax forecast was developed with a whole host of historical data and of information about upcoming events to inform quarterly targets. This is the first year for the tourism program that we're using quarterly targets, so we will have a sense throughout the year as to where we're tracking and if we're hitting our marks in terms of revenue.
Okay. So it was, what, $2.5 million in 2019? Wait, this budget book, page 194, says 2020 is going to be about $2.5 million. You've got $3 million there.
So that's modified. That's what you've received. Is that budget or is that received?
Total recommended, total what is projected to be the budget. 2.489.
Right, that's the tourism promotion. That was the math that I did on the side there.
Okay.
The 2.4 is the grant programs, the tourism promotion, and then you have to add $500,000 on top of that for the other allocations.
Allocations. So the $3 million on the slide is the revenue, and these are the allocations. Okay. Got it. I see. Now this is going to sound, I don't know. Does the room tax revenue include the homeless shelter clients who go to the hotels?
Those are tax-exempt stays, so no.
Okay. Right.
State doesn't pay that.
Yeah. Okay. All right, thank you.
This may be a Rick question. Rick, are our collections up to date with the people that we're taxing, the hoteliers? Do we have any trouble collecting? In the past, we've had trouble with some of them.
Typically, yes, we have had good success, and most are paid up to date. We have one large one that has been behind for a number of years, and we just entered into an agreement that the attorney's office helped us pen and put together, so they are now on a two-year payment plan to get caught up to date. It took us quite a few months to negotiate back and forth, but we'd rather have them on some kind of plan to bring them current. So the short answer is yes, but we do have one or two exceptions.
But you're working on those.
We're always working.
All right, thanks. Martha, again?
Right, so just mulling this over. So a 4% increase for 2020 sounds good, but we've been hearing from the hotels that they have increasing vacancies and they're worried. How do I put those two together?
Bed and breakfast. I mean the bed and breakfast.
A lot of the growth has been in our smaller market size. So we currently track properties that have 10 rooms or less because they pay a lower room tax rate. And if you look historically over the last 4 or 5 years, a lot of the growth has been happening in that segment. In addition, we are forecasting some additional rooms coming online, and that should have a net positive impact on the market, even if it doesn't have a net positive impact for each property.
Okay, so you're saying short-term rentals, Airbnb or whatever, that's actually showing up here because they're paying room tax.
Jason?
Oh, yeah, 3%.
Yeah, I would just add, I spent a little bit more time, I think, than usual working out the projections, because I was a little skeptical of the same question. And I actually had Nick do a good evaluation to show, at the end of the day, room taxes being collected is growing. The proportion, and correct me if I'm wrong, Nick, the proportion that is coming from hotels is decreasing, while the proportion that is coming coming from the smaller 10 and under is increasing. Is that correct?
Yep, that's correct.
So overall, you're seeing growth. You may be seeing some difference changes in the proportion, the breakup of where that revenue is coming from.
Thank you.
Anna?
Correct me if I'm wrong. We get we collect room tax 5% from hotels and 3% through Airbnb, and Airbnb collects it automatically.
That's correct. So we have a voluntary collection agreement with Airbnb where with every transaction that happens inside of Tompkins County, they
automatically
do that. The host never sees the money hit their account.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to be done at 8:30. We've got about 8 minutes. Any other questions? Katie, thank you very much. Well, we have a hand up at the last minute.
Sorry, let's use 8 minutes. We had visitors on Tuesday, and you started to discuss water and your programming. And it sounded like you had some ambitious stuff going on in that area. Do you think what you will be doing would address what they were asking for in terms of the coordination role? I was really impressed by the number of people that or organizations that signed that letter. And it seemed to be they were asking for some overall guidance and planning.
Yeah, I think to some extent we could fill that role. I don't think it's everything they're asking for. For instance, it isn't going to include writing grants for municipalities and administering and managing their grants. What we have in the comprehensive plan update that we're planning to bring you next month are several actions that would be looking to address some of those issues. We've got 14 actions that we're proposing modifying the comprehensive plan with, and four of them would have a direct impact on water resources, and three of them would have potentially a pretty strong indirect impact. So I feel like our work program is going to be shifting somewhat to be looking more at water. So I do feel like we'll be bringing additional resources with our existing staff to be working on water at the county scale. For instance, we're going to be looking at creating a HAB strategy by taking the harmful algal bloom information that we have so far from our Cuga Lake and Owasco Lake and coming up with a real action strategy that's ready to go. And we have staff, like I mentioned the other night, we have staff on board who are very well suited to be able to do that kind of work. So it's, you know, more resources could always get more done. I don't know where housing such resources would make sense. You know, the state is looking at soil and water as the big place for HAB's money to be funneled through. And I know I've had a couple conversations with the health department and soil and water, and regardless of what is decided here with that position, we're planning on meeting early in the year as we are working through our work program so we can try to address some of these issues.
Katie, thank you very much. Joan, thanks for being here, too. Thanks to Kathy Covert and Marsha Lynch. Who's pointing at what? I'm sorry?
I didn't think Nick.
Nick. Thank you, Nick.
And Nick.
Nick.
And Joan. Welcome.
Sorry.
And Amy.
My apologies.
Amy. Rick.
And Amy's here, and Jim Blizzard's up in the control room.
Thank you.
See, when you try to thank everybody, you always miss somebody. But
I know.
Please take no offense.
Yeah.
We will be back on Monday. We have 8 departments to talk to with 21 over-target requests.